is that the audience quickly got behind Roger Dowd's. Producer Ronan Kelly told me that that was in large part because of the game show host, Gay Byrne.
And Gay Byrne was a huge figure in Irish broadcasting up to a couple of years ago. I used to produce his show. And if you listen to the way Gay talked and made references to Roger's mother, he fed that. You know, there was no way the audience was going to think that this was just a guy in to win money. Gay told the story. Gay painted the picture. Gay filled in the gaps, which is, here's a guy who is grieving the death of his mother. Here's a guy who works in a nursing
home. His mother died 3 years ago.
3 years previously. And because we're all off the culture, we know what that means, and we know what that means to him. We can read the subtext, and that's why the audience got behind him. I mean, also the fact that he was doing well in the money, but also, sure. You know, we took our cue from Gay.
Well, let's listen to this next excerpt here.
Around the time I was on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I started going to a counsellor, who I'm still going to. I think she's, you know, helped with sort of relieving me of the awful kind of self-hatred.
Why did you decide you needed her?
I got very friendly with quite an elderly man, and as I say, it was the summer just before I went to school, and college, yeah. And I used to go and visit him, and unfortunately, you know, he started abusing me. And although I was 18, I was 12, you know, I hadn't had sex education of any kind. I didn't really consent to anything, but I allowed this to happen for about a year. And I don't know, because I suppose in some way I valued his attention. Then I, you know, finally, because I'd never not confided in my mother, so I did eventually confide in her about this. And it was a very difficult thing for her. She was used to kind of sweeping things aside, putting them under the carpet.
Did you
lost a little bit of something with my mother that day, you know.
I'm sorry, I missed that. You what?
I kind of lost a little bit of something with my mother. I idealized her so much, and, you know, she was so wonderful. And
Did you go back to the elderly man?
I went once, but I didn't. I remember going once to the door and talking to him, and I made up some outlandish story and, well, lies. So as a result of that, he, you know, kind of didn't want to have anything more to do with me. Anyway, I suppose I pretended I'd gone off with someone else, you know.
Did he think there was something else in what you were doing?
How do you mean, sorry?
Well, did he see it as in the same way as you did, or did he see it as something else? Did he see it as abuse, or did he see as a relationship?
No, he probably saw it as a relationship or something. I don't think he would have had any sense of the abuse I was feeling. At that point, I think I could have let anyone do anything to me, you know. You know, I'd so little self-esteem, I suppose I couldn't, you know, it's like as if I became mute and I couldn't shout stop. I'm very sure I know this one, Gay. I couldn't believe the audience's response. They were going to collapse.
They're really behind you.
Extraordinarily.
Well, then, perhaps may I explain the situation you're in, Roger. You have £125,000. You walk now. There's the check. I have it. You can walk now with that. If you go for this and get it wrong, you lose £93,000.
That's a bit drastic, all right. I do know a bit about birds, and that is my final answer. Okay.
Final answer.
Final answer.
You had £125,000, Roger. You now have
The old audience had won it themselves. Imagine having to take home a cartload of money here. I want to shed a few tears now. All I was going through my head was that Gay Byrne himself had lost a lot of money.
Don't start crying on me at this stage. The next question is worth £500,000.
I feel I want to look at it, actually.
Look at it.
Okay.
Ah, now, what do you think of that?
What does a vexillologist study...
I didn't think much.
A vexillologist study. Is it?
I think my brain had seized up. I couldn't...
Scorpions.
Come up with anything?
Flags. Or skin diseases. Vexillologist. And if you look at me and say, funnily enough, Gay, I know the answer.
Funnily enough, I know the answer.
You were very entertaining, weren't you?
Yeah, I was surprised, you know, how many people thought I was entertaining. No, I'll have to be quite honest.
Were you disappointed you hadn't got an easy one?
Well, I couldn't believe my luck up to that. I was carried on in the tide of wanting to keep going, just... Not even to do with the money, just I was enjoying being up there in some way. So I didn't want to stop. What's the word? I shall retire now, or whatever I should say. To get all this positive feedback from other people was extraordinary. To feel I was, you know, worth something and people could admire me and...
It says, pay Roger Dowds £250,000. Take it with our blessing and our thanks. You were a lovely, lovely competitor and played extremely well. You deserve it. Thank you very much.
I love it. At one point, Roger even says, I was treated like royalty. You know, in the end, he won all this money, and the one thing he buys for himself is a piano organ, but he still lives in this ordinary house, a fairly ordinary life. But do you think it brought him a peace of mind in the end?
It brought him a certain confidence, but... I rang him before coming over here and he had been due to go on holidays to Canada. And he said, I decided not to. And I said, why did you decide not to? I don't know, I just couldn't face it. And I thought that was disappointing. It's interesting listening back to it. The impact for me, and maybe I'm very egocentric, but I insert myself a lot into stories that I hear. And when he was talking about his vulnerability and how he was at a certain stage in his life so low, he would let anybody do anything to him, I could identify with that. He sang that song so well. I was like, oh, yeah, I know that. I mean, your life represents a part of my life that, you know, maybe with age we get to control. But God Almighty, that is that feeling that you have when for weakness or lack of courage or whatever, you just don't say what you should say. You don't do what you should do. And interestingly enough, I always ring the interviewees after the programs just to see how they felt about it because you're exposing yourself. And I rang him to discover that he was actually listening to the program with someone, which I was surprised at. And not only that, but with an elderly woman who was a friend of his who may have, he thought, disapproved of him if she heard his story. So what he had actually done was get me to tell the story to the elderly woman about his life. And I thought that was interesting. I thought it was an interesting way of using the program.
Ronan Kelly is the producer of the documentary Millionaire, which received an honorable mention award in this year's Third Coast Festival Richard H. Driehaus Foundation competition. I'm Alex Kotlowitz, and you're listening to the 2006 Third Coast Festival broadcast. Coming up, a tale of fantastic coincidence, beginning with a goat, a cow, and a box of letters flying down a road. To learn more about Third Coast and to hear the complete winning works, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This next award winner is a quest of a different sort. This story, Goat on a Cow, was produced by Laura Starcheski, Chad Abumrad, and Ellen Horn. Here, in this first of two excerpts, we meet the subject of Goat on a Cow, a young teacher, Eric Gordon, who's driving down California's Highway 101 with his friend. His friend sees something so amazing by the side of the road, they have to loop around for a second look. This is where this strange journey begins.
20 minutes later, they arrive back at the field.
So we pull over, and she just gets the hugest grin on her face. There is, in fact, a goat standing on a cow's back.
Still there.
We sit in the truck for a minute watching this cow, who's close enough to the fence that we've got a very good view of it. And every time he takes a step to graze, the goat kind of shifts from side to side, balancing.
So they're kind of this unit.
And it was, I mean, really amazing. You actually could see the goat's hoofs kind of bunch up in the cow's skin.
And
we get out of the truck.
They slowly get out of the truck to get a better look.
And right as I shut the door,
The goat jumps off.
And it just, you know, we're standing there kind of dumbfounded. We move up to the fence and just...
Believe it or not, the story gets weirder.
Really?
Yeah, so Eric and his friend are standing totally still, hoping that if they just wait, maybe the goat will jump back onto the cow. And all of a sudden, Eric's friend notices something at her feet.
She bends down and picks up a letter.
A letter.
Right in front of the fence.
And it's old.
And it's kind of...
like 50 years
like
old.
Like a crisp brown. Then we looked at the postmark, and it was 1952. I open this thing up and read it, and it's almost about nothing.
My dear, I wrote you a card after receiving the first one.
Yeah, see, some of these are so tough to read. So I look down on the ground, and there's another letter.
I've been slowly getting on my feet again.
And another.
Ed is so much better. Looks like that's her looped F.
And another.
Albertine sings very well indeed, since you ask. She took.
They were blown, literally, in this line down the side of the highway. And we looked at each other and frantically started gathering these letters, filling our arms with them. Letters from the 1920s, I see a 1937 postmark, and then she shouts from a couple feet away, 1897, 1890. And I'm gathering, my arms are getting full. I run to the truck and grab a garbage bag and I start filling it up. And then I start to notice Ella Chase, Ella Chase, Ella Chase, Ella Chase. These letters are all written to the same woman.
Over 300 letters, all written to one woman, Ella Chase.
You know, forget the goat and the cow. Now we're standing in the middle of somebody's whole life correspondence spread out on the side of Highway 101. And we just read. And we read and we read into the night.
Producer Laura Starcheski heard about these letters and became obsessed with finding out just who is this woman, Ella Chase, who died 50 years ago. Laura soon pulled a friend into the hunt.
Dear Mom?
It's not her son. It's one of these letters from the World War II soldiers who all called her Mom.
Oh, wow.
As soon as I started showing Marina the letters, her face kind of lit up.
Wow, she is amazing.
The first thing we decided to do was to go to a historical society.
This woman, and we know that she lived in Lomita Park.
Oh, jeez.
Since this is for Daly City, I assume... So I went back and looked at census records to find out a little bit more about her.
We found out that Ella had two granddaughters who were still alive. So we sent letters to her granddaughters, but they'd never respond. Day two.
Stay straight to go onto Napa Valley Highway.
My idea, my fantasy this whole time has been, we'll go to her house. The address that's on the letters.
Well, it's worth a shot.
Yeah, why not?
Maybe bring one of the letters.
It was a single-story house, little rose garden. I think houses have a strong history. Someone there will be able to tell us something about her.
Are they coming?
I don't know. Huh.
No answer. So we tried a neighbor.
What is it you want?
Hi, I'm sorry to bother you. I'm looking to find information about a woman.
I have no idea.
House.
We're new here in Napa.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Ugh. The missing husband.
I can't find anything on him at all. He's a complete mystery.
I mean, there were a lot of unanswered questions, so we knew that we had to find Ella's obituary. Day three, the Napa Public Library. We're in front of the microfiche and we're scrolling through dates.
It's August 22nd.
This was kind of our last hope.
Look.
The death notice comes up on the screen.
Chase in Napa, Monday, July 4th, 1955.
We scan it as fast as we can for any new name that we haven't seen before.
Rexford C. Green Milbrae.
Almost right away we notice.
Robert.
Robert Lyley.
That's a grandson.
There was a grandson.
A grandson. We had never seen this name before. He was listed.
Hi, this is Bob.
Hi, this is Carol.
We're either down at the store getting some milk or...
We don't know where we're at, but we're somewhere. Bye.
Hi, this is a message for Robert Lyley. My name is Laura Starcheski. I'm a reporter, and I'm doing a story about a woman who I believe is your grandmother. Her name was Ella.
I wanted to hear a voice. I wanted a voice. Marina returned to Los Altos to get back to her life, and I waited. One day passed, then another. I didn't get a call back from him. Day six. It was Marina.
Marina?
She hadn't been able to stop researching.
It's really sad.
What is it?
Well, in 1938, she filed for divorce.
Uh-huh.
And there's a series of articles where he denies that they were married.
Really?
She pleaded with me to marry her. Ella did, but we couldn't get along, and I refused to do it.
She was desperate for money.
Mm-hmm.
She needed to sell the house. She couldn't do that without divorcing her husband.
Trial of sensational I'm Not Married case expected in June.
It went on for like a year, the huge headlines. Ella said they were married. Bellman, her husband, says that they never were. Ella couldn't produce a marriage certificate, and then finally the whole thing ended with her just sitting in the courtroom refusing to answer questions.
Ella A. Chase of Lomita Park, still adamant and defiant, but this time alone, steadfastly refused to answer questions.
And then...
And that really wasn't the worst of it.
And then I found this really sad article...
From a few years later.
Let me find this.
Christmas, 1942. Death took no holiday. On Christmas Eve, Bellman Chase wandered along, dimmed out south of Market. He had been drinking heavily. He was separated from his wife and family. Perhaps he was trying to erase thoughts that come to men at such times. Christmas Day, sprawled on his back on a sidewalk, he died. The warm sun shone clear on the fractured nose and the blue bruise on his chin. Looks like the bum is dead, someone said.
A couple days later, it says that his body was left unclaimed in the morgue.
Really?
And they were not able to locate his estranged wife.
Really?
It suddenly made sense. It was right after that that she started writing to World War II soldiers.
she probably needed them as much as they needed her.
Goat on a Cow, by independent producer Laura Starcheski, along with Chad Abumrad and Ellen Horn, for WNYC's Radio Lab, the recipient of the festival's Silver Award. In this next piece, the producer is also front and center, but in a more personal way. Jodie Porter, a Canadian journalist, was the victim of sexual abuse by her father. And as she says at the beginning of her story,
my story, in 100 different versions, sits in my closet, on a shelf. I've written pieces of it a million times. I've gone to court with my story, and it still hangs around.
Producer Jodie Porter did something, well, personally risky. As we hear in this first excerpt from Between Friends, she turned the microphone on herself.
My dad has been a teacher, a town counselor, a businessman. I've been an unwed mother, a troubled teen, a strange little girl. But I did something important when I was that little girl. I told my best friend what my father was doing to me. My friend Melissa testified in court. Only Melissa knew what my life was really like when I was a kid. She believed me. But in court, it was up to the judge.
I can remember walking into the courtroom and the judge went on and on and on. Honestly, it was for hours. It took him 2.5 hours to deliver his decision. And he'd start into a part of it where you'd think, okay, he really understood. And you'd just get so that you were feeling like everything was going to be okay. And then he'd start going into my father's testimony. And I'd think, holy shit, he bought that bastard's story. He bought that story. And then finally, he did get it. He caught on to my dad's lie.
Jerry, let me ask, what led you to tell this incredibly personal story in such a public way?
I think coming out of the court experience, court is such an unsatisfying thing for someone who's used to storytelling and narrative. You don't actually get the sense that you've told your story. The court is very much interested in facts, but not so much in truth. And I felt like I had a truth to tell. And also, I was getting into an area of reporting where I was asking a lot of people to share their personal stories with me. And I wasn't sure I really trusted our medium to be a medium for those personal stories.
Trusted the medium or trusted yourself?
No, the medium, very much, because I had moved from sort of advocacy journalism into mainstream journalism. And I wasn't sure all the hoops and cogs and wheels you have to turn to get a piece to air. I wasn't sure that that was a safe thing to ask people to do. And so for me, this was a little bit of a test of that as well.
She really put herself to the test by confronting her mom.
Where was I in all that? Like, what was wrong with me? Like, was I so bloody wrapped up in my own selfish life that I couldn't see what was in front of me?
My mom.
Like, even sitting in court listening to you, I don't remember a lot of that. But where was I? Like, and that's the thing I'm left with, was where was I and what was I thinking?
Is there guilt?
Yeah, there's guilt, because the thing I hate worse in the world is somebody thinking I'm stupid. And to me, that's the stupidest I've ever been in my life. Like, how can you not protect your own child?
It meant a lot to me that my mom sat behind me in the courtroom. And she did her best to help with my case. But it was Melissa. Melissa made the difference. I didn't realize until she testified in court. And then it really struck me that, like, she's been carrying this thing around with her since she was 10, She's been carrying it around, too. And I put that on her. All that's bundled up in what happened to me, she had to live with, too. I put a burden on Melissa. Like, for 20 years, she's lived this story along with me. So I'm glad it was her that got burdened with this, but I'm sorry, too.
Melissa and I are still best friends, but we didn't talk for a long time after the court case, and I felt like I just didn't know what to say. Finally, after about a year, I called her up.
Melissa, do you think this is over for me now?
Unfortunately, no. I hope it's closed, but I don't think it's over. As your best friend, I want this to end for you. I really don't think you're ever going to get what you want from your parents. And of course, for me, I'd like this to end. When I think the whole thing over, the best support that you ever got out of this was probably from that 10-year-old girl I was. I never considered questioning you or reporting it or telling you to accept it or get over it. I was just heartbroken that my best friend was being hurt. And I probably do know you best. You just don't know how small of a piece this is of who you are.
I think this is all of who I am. Like, I feel like this is...
And as much as I remember crying with you that night being 10, I can as clearly remember how much I thought you were before this even happened.
I'm just so glad it was you. What have you learned from going through all this with me?
I guess looking back, how strong a friendship can be, even when you're little girls.
Yeah, I hope our girls find friends like us.
Sorry.
When I look at my daughter, it's kind of like an epiphany every time I see her. So that's what it's like to be a kid. She gives me hope because I was so screwed up. But she's okay. And I'd do almost anything to keep it that way.
Well, one of my elves has broken a world record for making 2037.
The conclusion of Between Friends. Amazingly enough, this story almost didn't get heard. Jody Porter, who produces for the CBC, had to go to court to get this piece on the air.
In Canada, there is a publication ban on victims' names in sexual assault cases. And I know this from covering court, and there had been a publication ban placed on my name. I had talked to the prosecutor in my case before I started making the piece, and he said he didn't think there'd be a problem. Once the piece was made, we went back and made sure that it was all going to be okay. And it turned out, according to the courts, I wasn't allowed to tell my story.
You couldn't reveal your own name.
I couldn't reveal my own identity. I could not say that I was the victim of sexual assault. So CBC very generously covered the court costs to go to court to get the publication ban lifted. My dad fought it, so there had to be another hearing. And it's funny because we never mention his name. The piece never mentions his name.
Right, and of course, the law is that they are not to protect the abuser. It's there to protect the abused.
Yes, yes. But here was this fortunate opportunity for him to try and protect himself once more. So that went on for a full year. Then we won. If you ever win in court, I won in court again. and we were able to put the piece to air.
And you won the right to reveal your name and reveal what
and
happened.
This is kind of an ongoing theme in Canadian law right now. So my court battle to reveal my own name was a small precedence. So every person that comes forward and asks for the publication ban to be lifted on their name, it's one more step towards victims actually having more rights.
And in the end, in some ways, all you were asking for is just the right to tell your story.
Yes.
Between Friends, produced by Jody Porter and Neil Sandel for the CBC's Out Front, it took home this year's Third Coast Festival's Radio Impact Award. I'm Alex Kotlowitz, and you're listening to the 2006 Third Coast Festival broadcast. Coming up, the story of a song unlike any other. To learn more about the festival and hear the complete winning works, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Wrestling with the past is a theme that pops up in a number of this year's winning documentaries, trying to make sense of what was so we can better understand what is. Mira Burt Wintonick's grandmother died when Mira was 12 years old. That was 10 years ago. And as Mira became an adult, she began to lose hold of her memories of her grandmother, who she had considered her best friend. Then one day in the basement of her parents' home, at the bottom of a box, she found a plain black cassette tape, which had scribbled on the side Muriel's message.
Looking at the tape in my hand, I wondered what kind of message it could be. Some posthumous guidance from beyond the grave, or maybe a long-held family secret, confessed at last to the bipartisan particles of magnetic tape. I hurried upstairs, slid it into my stereo, and pressed play.
Muriel Burt here. I'll call you right back. 681-8305 here.
The message played over and over again on a loop. Not quite the revelation I'd imagined, but somehow I couldn't stop listening. The first few times I wondered if the tape had been mislabeled. Was that really her speaking? Was that really what she sounded like?
Muriel Burt speaking.
How could I not remember?
8305. I'll call you right back. Muriel Burt here. I'll call you right back.
The longer I listened, the more familiar her voice became, and with it came a rush of long-forgotten memories. Now there are photos of my grandmother all over our house, some tucked neatly into their picture frames, while others fight with post-it notes and grocery lists for prime real estate on a refrigerator door. Somehow none of them had ever made me stop and think about her, the way hearing her voice after all these years made me stop and think about her. It made me think about taking the train to her house in London, Ontario every summer, and climbing the huge crabapple tree in her backyard. It made me think about driving out to the chip wagon on the beach, so we could throw our French fries in the air under a sky of swarming seagulls. It made me think about the way she smelled when I'd snuggle up to her on the couch for a bedtime story. The perfect mix of soap suds and Wrigley's spearmint gum. And it made me think about our giggle fits on lazy afternoons when all we needed was each other's company. Lost my grandmother's memory as much as I thought I had. Memories aren't meant to get stuck in your head like some cheesy love song. They lay still and quiet below the hum of everyday life until the sound of someone's voice allows them to resurface.
Long game at the same crocodile as can be. He'd went snap and then there were one little one.
That was Muriel's message. Mira Burt-Wintonik, who is a student at Montreal's Concordia University, produced this story in part as a Christmas gift for her mom. It aired on her student radio station and also got the attention of the Third Coast Festival judges, who named her the year's best new artist. This next piece is also inspired by the loss of a loved one. When Rebecca Shear's grandmother died, Rebecca realized she knew little about the Jewish rituals surrounding death. So in Iowa City, where she was living at the time, she spoke with individuals who had participated in tahara, a ritualistic preparation of the body for burial. It can be done by friends and family of the deceased, as well as by complete strangers. Honoring the Body by Rebecca Shear, an excerpt.
None of us had ever participated in one of these things before. And so we weren't making it up as we went along. We were going very much from a list of directions that had been put together for what you're supposed to do, beginning on the right side. You pour the water from top to bottom. Then you do the left side, and you turn the body over, and you do the genitals, and finally you do the head. At the end of that process of pouring three buckets of water over the body, then the members of the team, of the group, will recite
Tahara-hi, Tahara-hi, Tahara-hi.
She's pure, she is pure,
she is pure.
And then when she was fully washed, I remember we had to put her in the Jewish ceremonial burial garb.
Judaism says quite explicitly that we come into the world all the same. We're all, you know, slimy and naked. And it's important that we are supposed to leave this world all the same. And that's why we cover the body in a very simple white garment that's supposed to be the same for anybody, regardless of their level of wealth or their level of prominence in the community.
It's like a white tunic and white pants and then a sash that you had to tie. I believe it was 13 times around the
Just
waist.
Just as the tefillin, the straps and boxes that are used for morning prayers, are tied in such a way that the letters making up God's name are actually written on your body as you're praying. They use a special set of knots for tying the sash in order to create the letter Sheen, which is the first letter in the name Shaddai, which is one of the names of God. The other letters, Dalet and Yud in Shaddai, are also there by how the ends of the sash are hanging, so that the three letters can actually be read across the body of the Met. And then we put them into a simple casket.
We had to put her in actually a cardboard box that was like stapled together that she was going to be shipped in. She had advanced cancer, and they came here for treatment. They were from Connecticut, and so she died here, and she wasn't going to be buried here, but she needed to be washed here. And then her body was shipped back to Connecticut for burial.
It's customary to sprinkle afar, which is just it's dust, often from the land of Israel, onto the body, but not entering the body, onto the outside of the eyes, the heart, the genital area. It's about the connection between Adam and Adama. Adam meaning humanity, Adam being Adam, the first person, and Adama, the earth. It's all about bringing that connection to full circle.
And on the bottom of the box, there was sand. That was from Israel, that's a piece of this thing that you get buried with Eretz Yisrael, and the land of Israel goes with you into the grave.
In Israel, burials often take place without a coffin at all, because an even more traditional Jewish way of burial is to cover the body in a cloak and put it into the ground. Because the old saying, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, we truly believe that. You want the body to deteriorate into the earth and to return to where it came from initially.
I remember being a little girl and burying my great aunt Anna and just thinking, oh, that's how I want to go. It just seemed completely right to me to go into a wooden box into the ground and disintegrate over time.
An excerpt from Honoring the Body by Rebecca Shear, a Director's Choice honoree at this year's Third Coast Festival. There's a time for mourning and a time for singing. I like to think that we in radio know how to indulge our guilty pleasures now and again. Alan Hall sure does. He's the founder of Falling Tree Productions in London and decided to have a little fun. He took one of the most beloved and some might say one of the most reviled pop songs of all time and put it under the microscope. He dissected it with the help from a few musicians and he called the piece Rhapsody in Bohemia. Here's the first of two excerpts.
If you found it embarrassing in 1975, you still find it embarrassing. If you loved it then, you probably still love it. But it is clearly something that once heard, never forgotten.
In 1975, I was 10 years old. I wasn't really into music.
Too late, my time has come. Sent shivers down my spine.
As a young 8 or 9 year old growing up in suburban South London, being exposed to Freddie Mercury and Queen is always going to have some kind of effect, lasting kind of effect on you.
Joby Talbot, composer and former pop musician.
I sort of divide my time between writing concert pieces for the, you know, classical concert hall and also working with different bands and writing music that kind of sometimes falls between those two worlds, which is a sort of an interesting thing about being a composer in, you know, the beginning of the 21st century. I think that wouldn't necessarily have been such a viable option back in good old 1975, when you rather were in one camp or the other, full stop. Having played in a band for a number of years, you spend so much of your time practicing going from one section to the next, and just like, you know, the absolute snap changes, the way that they can just get from one section to the next, something that you could never really hope to capture with an orchestra in the concert hall, because it's such a sort of lumbering beast. And the other thing is, of course, the production on it is beautiful.
Sent shivers down my spine, body's aching all the time.
Right down to that bit where Freddie talks about shivers down his spine and somebody drops an anvil in the background. I think it's meant to be shivery sound effect.
It's actually not a bad voice at all. It's a thin but pleasant sound, and he stays pretty well in tune, and, you know, light and crooning. And a lot of use of falsetto, of course, that lets the lighter tones go into it.
Falsetto, a technique by which a mature male voice can reach notes of the soprano range.
You know, that's a very useful male resource, isn't it? You've got another whole sort of gear there you can go into. It did go down into that rather smooth, sort of light, adolescent kind of tenorino, you can even call them, because you've got the sort of high stuff is still there from the boy soprano days, you know. And it's, I mean, obviously, most pop singers' voices are much thinner, you know. They don't have as much vibrato, or they don't have as much support in their voices. They don't have as much opportunity to colour their voices and do more dramatic colours and really big stuff. But, of course, the microphone and the studio technicians and the amazing skills involved can, you know, enhance what is actually a very, very small sound.
Mama!
That was from the program Rhapsody in Bohemia, which aired on the BBC. Among those producer Alan Hall interviewed were an opera singer, the founder of a Queen tribute band, and a classical music DJ. But his favorite contributor was a classical music critic for the Times of London.
I approached her and asked her if she'd just do a review of the song, as if it were a classic piece. And she said, yes, sure. I can't bring it to mind, but I'm sure I will. I'll have a look. I said, well, if you haven't got a copy, don't worry, I'll play it to you in the studio. She turned up at the studio and she said, I'm afraid I haven't found a copy. And I still can't quite remember what it sounds like. And so I sat next to her and played her the song. And there was not a flicker of recognition. She had never heard the song Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, which of course made it a much more exciting moment. And surprisingly, perhaps, her innocent ear response was that actually it was somewhat underwhelming.
Yeah, she didn't like it.
She just thought it was a bit dull, which was great because other people have been talking about the complexities of the chord progressions and so on. She came in and countered that completely, which was wonderful.
I'm curious. I mean, they ask in the song at one point, does any song really matter? And of course they do. I mean, they're touchstones for all of us. And I guess I'm wondering, do you remember where you were when that song made it to number one on the charts?
I think it's one of those songs that's just always been in the ether. I don't know that you can ever remember the first time you heard it. It's one of those universal songs. There aren't that many of them. It's a bit like Beethoven's Fifth. It's a piece of music that has a significance for everyone, whether they realize it or not.
Kind of like Beethoven's Fifth? Let's hear a little more from Rhapsody in Bohemia.
Roger Taylor, in particular, in that operatic section, is singing and holding high B flats. High B flat, that's like nearly an octave above Pavarotti's highest note. That one there, two octaves above.
It's an octave up from that.
I mean, that's just superhuman. I'm not sure whether it's even legal to sing that high. And all in tune.
I actually put together a Queen medley with my pub band, specifically so I could play that riff. This is the Wayne's World part.
Just at that point where most people had probably either taken it completely for granted or maybe even forgotten about it, right near the beginning of the film, they have this tribute to Bohemian Rhapsody and think, oh yeah, actually, you know, Queen, pretty cool band. Because actually, Queen were never really cool. And I think they probably put the effort in to make sure that they weren't cool. The famous moment is when you get to the rock section. And it's a wonderful moment where they all do the same thing together, straight in with a hard headbanging rocker bit, and they bond. As four people, you see them bond listening to this song. And they do what we've all done, probably, at some point, with whatever song it is, sing along in the car as if you haven't got a care in the world and your world really is this song and your collective experience of enjoyment.